The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So this morning we're going to look into a koan from one of the classical collections called the Blue Cliff Record. During a Dharma talk, we ask that you sit upright in Zazen posture, just like you would for any Zazen practice, and that you receive the talk from within your formal practice. I'll read the koan and comment a little bit on it, and then David will take up the second part of our Dharma talk this morning and conclude and introduce what's next. So this is the case from the Blue Cliff Record, number 18. Emperor Suzong asked national teacher Wei Zhang, "After you die, what will you need?" The national teacher said, "Build a seamless monument for me." The emperor said, "Please tell me, master, what the monument would look like." The national teacher was silent for a long time. Then he asked, "Do you understand?" The emperor said, "I don't understand." The national teacher said, "I have a disciple to whom I have transmitted the teaching, Dan Yuan, who is well versed in this matter. Please summon him and ask him about it." After the national teacher passed on, the emperor summoned Dan Yuan and asked him what the meaning of this was. Dan Yuan said, "South of Xiang, north of Tan." And Shui Do adds the comment, "A single hand does not make a random sound. In between, there's gold sufficient to a nation." And Shui Do comments, "A rough-hewn staff. Beneath the shadowless tree, the community ferry boat." Shui Do adds, "The sea is calm, the rivers are clear." Within the crystal palace, there's no one who knows. And Shui Do adds the comment, "The Taisho is finished." And the verse to this koan goes like this. The seamless monument. To see it is hard. The dragon does not thrive in a placid lake. Layers upon layers, shadows upon shadows, forever and ever it is shown to people. So when we encounter a koan, it's important to know that on first hearing it, or maybe you've heard it before, it's not always that clear. And that's a normal reaction to a koan, so nothing to worry about. We'll be talking about it, David and I, and also in evening encouragement talks, it's possible that Paul and Michael will refer to it. So little by little, it will become maybe more clear. But even if it doesn't, the instruction is always to notice, just as we notice with our liturgy service, just as we notice with any of the teachings of Zen, how it touches our own hearts. There may be a word or two that zings out from the story or from this talk and commentary from David and me. And if something like that happens, that's simply something to notice. This is not meant to be a sermon or a lecture. It's not meant to be a test of something. It's an inspiration towards looking as deeply as possible into your own heart mind, which is what, for me, Zen is all about. The characters in this story lived a long time ago. They lived in the 8th century in China. And the first character is a great teacher who was known as the national teacher. And he was a Dharma heir of Wei Nung, who was known as the sixth ancestor. He was Wei Neng was quite a famous teacher. There are many stories about him. He's called the sixth ancestor because he's six down the transmission from Bodhidharma, who was the first Chinese ancestor. And Wei Neng had many disciples, and over the many years of the national teacher's life, his Dharma heir's life, the Dharma in China, the Zen version of the Dharma in China, split into many different sects and styles. But the national teacher was always recognized by every one of those sects as being an authority on the Great Way. And he was invited by three different emperors to come to the imperial palace and teach Zen. And these three emperors, one emperor who died, and then the second and third emperor were brothers to each other. And he taught all three of them. All three were sincere students of Zen. And this third student, the third emperor who studied with the national teacher, is the other person in the story. And then the third person in the story is the national teacher's own Dharma heir, who is famous in other ways, and maybe we'll get to talk about his discipleship, his training with the national teacher himself. But when we meet him, he's already an accomplished teacher and helps out the emperor, who's puzzled by his teacher's silence in the story. So the story is pretty simple, actually. There's a lot of poetry and metaphoric and flowery language surrounding it, but all of this language, as we say, is a finger pointing to the moon. That is, every single line in this koan points to the essential matter. So first, according to the histories of Zen, this story happened when the national teacher was dying. And some of you may know another story like this, where a great Zen master is dying, great master Ma, and he's asked, "How are you today?" And his answer is to say, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." That is, sun-faced Buddha lives 1,000 years, moon-faced Buddha lives for a day and a night. He's saying, sometimes things are really going well for me, and sometimes not so. And of course, many other things, which we delve in when we look into this koan. But in this case, when he's asked, after you die, by the emperor, what do you want me to do for you? How shall I behave? And in the original translation, in the original Chinese, the emperor says, after 100 years, what do you want me to do for you? And that's a way of being polite. When you die, what should I do for you? And of course, the national teacher is dying. He's very close to death. So his teaching probably has become refined to a very, we might say, a brilliant, sharp point. And so everyone who would hear this story would be looking forward to seeing what the dying great master, the master of all the teachers of Zen in China, would say in this point, the teacher of emperors, what he would say. And what he says is, build me a seamless monument, or in some translations, a seamless tomb. So monuments in the Zen tradition are sometimes quite fancy. They have lots of paint colors and gold trim, and they're in layers. Sometimes they're tiered like a big wedding cake. But he's referring to something much simpler than that, a seamless tomb, a seamless pagoda, a seamless monument, like a little hill of dirt to cover him. The emperor doesn't really get what he's pointing to. Maybe you don't either, but this is one of the most profound parts of this story. What does he mean by a monument that has nothing fancy to it, that is seamless, that is not decorated, that is plain, ordinary? What does he mean by this? And the emperor says, well, what do you want it to look like? What's the design of it? Tell me more about it. Tell me more about it is a question that is traditional for Zen students to ask their teachers. The teachers give some kind of instruction and a student will say, tell me more about this. I want to really know. Let me know the whole thing. Please, please, a sort of kind of humility. Let me know, let me understand. And the emperor of all China is asking this of this dying Zen teacher. And the dying Zen teacher, the great national teacher of China, says nothing. He's silent for a long time. Now, there are many kinds of silence in Zen. Sometimes silence is an indication of befuddlement, of confusion. Sometimes a student who's silent or even a teacher who's silent has nothing to say on the matter because they don't know how to respond. Sometimes the silence itself is the answer. And it's important to be in this place yourself. When you hear this story, put yourself in the place of the emperor of China asking the great teacher for some instruction, and the teacher offers nothing. A great silence. So is he offering nothing, or is the silence itself the offering? Well, this is also a matter for study. And then after a little while, the teacher says, do you understand? And the emperor says, I don't understand. Another answer that we find in many, many koans. I don't understand. Another emperor said to Bodhidharma, when Bodhidharma came from China and tried to explain Zen to that emperor, he didn't understand. He didn't know. Was he at peace with this not knowing, or was he truly confused? This is the question, again, that we investigate. What is it? What is it that happens here? And then the teacher dies, and he's instructed the emperor to go and seek more instruction from his own Dharma heir, this fellow who is another great teacher. And he asks him the same question, can you please explain to me what happened here, what was going on? And this Dharma heir, this teacher, after his teacher's death, tries to be helpful by giving us this beautiful poem. And the poem is South of Sheng, North of Tan, which is a way of talking about everywhere in the universe, because Sheng is as north as you can go, Tan is as south as you can go, so in between is everything. So everywhere you look, there's gold sufficient to a nation. There's enough gold to fill the country. Gold everywhere. And then he says, beneath the shadowless tree, the community ferry boat, the shadowless tree, which has many, many ways of understanding this, the tree under which perhaps the Buddha came to awakening, the shadowless tree, a tree that doesn't throw off a shadow, and this community ferry boat, a ferry boat that takes us all with it. Within the crystal palace, there's no one who knows. And there's that no knowing again. What is that all about? Within the crystal palace, within this beautiful structure, there's no one who knows. And then he says, the sea is calm and the rivers are rather. Nope, there's no one who knows. Within the crystal palace, there's no one who knows. That's the end of the poem. There are a lot of commentaries by the guy who collected this, but we won't go into them right now. And then there's the other poem, which is by the collector of the Blue Cliff Record, which we will also go into at another time. So just a little pointing to some of the places in the koan that need some context to understand them. And I know for me, there's a lot of poignancy in this story, a lot of poignancy for me as a teacher and also me as a student. How do I understand what happens after death, after the teacher leaves? What is the heritage that we all leave behind as teachers, as practitioners of the way? What do we want from our students? That's where I go first with this story. How do I want my students to work with me? Not to do what I say, but to sincerely investigate the matter with me. And this emperor, this really highfalutin guy, is so humble in this story. He really wants to understand what to do when his life is left with carrying on this great way. Every one of us who's here on the Zoom screen is dedicated to this path. As we said last night, everyone has already volunteered to investigate the great matter together through sitting, through coming to Doksan, through listening to these talks, through chanting the liturgy, through all of the things we do in between our formal practice. Every moment of our life, every moment of this so short life, we have decided to devote to this great way, at least for the weekend. And some of us, our whole life is dedicated to this. So after all of us are gone in 100 years, which is this typical Chinese way of saying after we're all dead, in 100 years, what will you do? And to continue investigating this, I will hand it over to David Roshi.
So many entry points, and this poignancy for me when Melissa speaks of that so touches me. This great life of coming and going, and the parents that gave birth to us, coming and going, and our many teachers. Of course, in some way, each person we meet is our teacher. But there are some people in our lives, some people in your life, that have touched you deeply. Perhaps a teacher or a mentor or a friend or a partner. Our life as we go on has been molded and changed by these different people that have somehow found their way into our hearts, and we continue without these people. The great, the five remembrances which we chant so often, actually not a Zen text, actually a Theravadan text that we have adopted. Because it speaks so directly to the heart of the matter. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Everything we have, everything that we are, is coming and going. And the people of our life, the people of your life, the dear ones that have made you who you are, they too are here. The ancestors we sing of in our sutra service, these teachers that we tell endless stories about. We are in a dynamic living relationship with all of these people. And as I think of the teachers in my life, my Zen teacher, my parents, my many teachers. For me, there is a gratitude that arises. And this question, what shall I do when you are gone? So, of course, in some way, never gone. But in some other way, we will be separated from the people we love. Our teachers that are here today will not be here at some point. And how do we carry on? And I'm reminded of a Simpsons episode. And the scene was between little Lisa. She, if you know the series, she studied the saxophone and was not very good. But then she got a famous jazz musician came to town, Bloody Gums Murphy, I think was his name. And Bloody Gums Murphy taught Lisa to play the saxophone. But really play the saxophone. And when you play the saxophone or when you really do something, it is a thing of great joy and beauty, surpassing anything that can be spoken of. And so he taught her, he passed down this wonderful tenor saxophone playing. But then the time came and he said, I have to go. I must leave you. And he's on the train. She's on the platform. And he says, she says to him, she says, Bloody Gums, how will I get on without you? What shall I do when you are gone? Just like the emperor to the national teacher. And from his seat inside the train, as the train is pulling out, Bloody Gums Murphy says, you are Lisa Simpson. You are Lisa Simpson. South of the North Pole and north of the South Pole, the land is filled with gold. This life that is particular to you abounds everywhere. The whole universe is singing. And the debt we owe to our teachers is to be ourselves, to dare to be who you are, to sit in silence, to wash the dishes, to brush your teeth. There is nowhere that there is any lack at all. Emperor Su Zhang asked the national teacher, Wei Zhang, after you die, what will you need? The national teacher said, build me a seamless monument for me. The emperor said, please tell me, master, what the monument would look like. The national teacher was silent for a long time. Then he said, "Do you understand?" The emperor said, "I do not understand." The national teacher said, "I have a disciple to whom I have transmitted the teaching, Tan Yuan, who is well versed in this matter. Please summon him and ask him about it." After the national teacher passed on, the emperor summoned Dan Yuan and asked him what the meaning of this was. Dan Yuan said, "South of the Xiang River and north of the Tan River, in between there's gold sufficient to a nation. Beneath the shadowless tree, the community ferry boat. Within the crystal palace, there is no one who knows." Thank you. So we invite you to sit comfortably, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. One technical thing in terms of Zoom and the Dharma dialogue, up in the upper right hand, there's a way you can change your view. If you're on gallery view, you will be seeing all of the squares. If you change to speaker view, you can just see just the one person who's talking. Oftentimes Melissa and I will do this. So when you're speaking, we have you on our screen, but whatever you prefer. And also, Michael Herzog will join us in responding to your comments and questions. So please raise your Zoom hand, and we'll call on you and investigate the matter.
Yes, we'll start with Adam.
You're still muted, Adam.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah.
I said I couldn't come on.
Oh, now you're going in and out.
Yep, got you now.
Okay.
You're right this moment. Yep.
All right, perfect. I just wanted to say this koan is truly north of Tan and south of Sean. I'm working up with this case, and I maybe in the back of my mind thought that I would avoid it. would come to Sesheed and something else would arise and
not have to deal with it.
No.
In general, we do try to keep that confidential where we are with koans and stuff, but I think it's wonderful that you're admitting to this.
So, yeah, I think I had in the back of my mind kind of this stowed away. And one thing I just wanted to say, I really appreciated one of the things that's been resonating for me with this case is thinking about people that, you know, have passed. And for me, this really touched me. My wife's grandmother was really close to us, and she's no longer here. And when I first heard this case, that brought up a lot of those feelings about her and about some of the things that my wife and I talk about, like you said, David, you know, in some ways people aren't gone. And one of the ways that that manifests for me is cardinals always used to remind my wife of her grandmother. And so recently I got her this gift of a watercolor painting of a cardinal. And just this morning, I know that these birds probably aren't cardinals that are around both of these places, but when you said, you know, the teacher stopped talking and was quiet for a while and then asked, "Do you understand?" In the in-between, I could just hear these birds and not tell whether it was the bird outside my window here or the bird there. And for a moment, it felt like I did understand. So I just...
right.
Yeah.
That means, so thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, sometimes it's important to be quiet and receive. And the birds are teaching us the Dharma all the time. The National Teacher actually is very famous for a response, another kind of response, where somebody asks him about the teachings of insentient beings, that is, non-human beings, and he points to the walls and the tiles, you know, and here's the birds teaching us. So how wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
Marla. Marla, we can't hear you yet either. You have to unmute.
There, I think we got you.
Maybe. Thank you. Yeah,
there you are. Yay. Yeah.
I think that has to do with the email that came out. I've got to change that setting. No, thank you. That was a great talk. I got really intrigued. I got really intrigued by the idea of randomness, that the, you know, the single hand doesn't sound randomly. And I went down a little track about, does that mean nothing's actually random? But then I think David added a new koan that kind of caught me even more at the end. And that is that what we owe our teachers and ancestors is to be our full selves. And that can be a huge koan for a lot of us. I mean, maybe a lot of people just naturally come to Zen. But I think I'm going to assume some other people are like me. It took us a while because it was different. And we had to go look for the resources that weren't around us, or maybe it wasn't really what anyone around us did. And it was a risk. And it's really hard to show up and be your full self without performing or putting on a facade or being what you want to be if you're not it yet. But that's really something I'm going to think about a lot too. So thank you for adding that extra koan at the end.
Well, you say if you're not it yet, I would say if you don't know yet that you are it, right? Because this, I think, is the most outrageous teaching of Zen, that you are fully enough, because all of us know that couldn't be true. Right? And we're quite firm in our opinion. I know that I am inadequate, right? And I have evidence. I can tell you stories. Look at this, look at that. But this incredible invitation, and as you say, takes some great courage. And I think it's connected to what Melissa said last night about this basic friendliness. So in our Zazen, in your Zazen, in my Zazen, can I risk being myself? Can I give up trying to be a good Zen student and do it right, and be with this, be with me? It's such a radical challenge. Yeah, thanks, Marla.
Marla, I just want to say that, you know, there's an element of trust here that that you can't make happen. It's almost like you have to open your heart and let trust come through. And nothing you can do, but a wonderful a practice of seeing it come.
Yeah, yeah, great.
Beautiful. Thank you, Marla. Will.
There we go. I was expecting not to be heard, but actually.
No, you came right on.
So thanks very much for the talk. This was really, particularly with all the following verses, this was a very hard going to kind of get a handle on, although it became clearer as you spoke. And I guess my question actually has to do, it maybe connects back to one of the readings we did in the liturgy service from the Lotus Sutra. And that was all of these things about, you know, if you, I can't remember the wording, but, you know, all the things you do are essentially going to allow you to see Buddha. And one of them is to honor the images. So I started thinking about images and tombs. First of all, I thought that a seamless monument was maybe impossible in 8th century China. And partly he was saying, don't build me a monument. But whether it's that or you know, a very plain monument, the implication, I think it would be easy to take away that monuments are unnecessary. We don't need monuments. That's vanity. On the other hand, the Lotus Sutra tells us that images are important. Similarly, you were speaking about the heritage and Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma is probably fictional, right? I think I'm guessing that Buddhism probably came to China in some way that we don't exactly know, lots of different things going on. But he's an important figure to us, even if he's fictional. And so this is the question, is that what are these images? Who are these made up people? If, you know, Buddhism is all about truth, reality. What's the relationship we have to the tomb where there is no one? Why is it important to honor the images?
Well, that's such a wonderful question. I really appreciate where your mind went in formulating it too, because you don't seem to be saying it should be like this. You're wondering in your question.
Yeah.
I appreciate that so much. And the little piece from the Lotus Sutra that we read is actually indicating something that for me personally as a teacher is one of the most important things. Every single human being that I meet has their own way of understanding the Dharma. Some of us need visual representations of Buddha figures. Some of us need to hear the cardinals singing outside. Some of us, I love it where it says, you know, just holding up a hand or nodding the head. So to find the thing that touches your heart, and I think Zen has a great menu. You get to click on all this different stuff and you don't have to buy it all, but you go, oh, you know, for me, it's this, for me, it's that, for me, it's this. And every single one is a Dharma gate, right? Mm-hmm. So for some people, those images are everything. And some people it's like, you know, images, idols, are you kidding me? No. And everything in between, it's, so there's some way that all of this stuff, all of the rituals and forms of Zen are agreements that we make with each other to hold dearly, but they're all just pointers and they're not the thing itself, and they are the thing itself, both, right? So when you bow to the Buddha statue, it's just, you know, our Buddha statue here, it's just a piece of clay that somebody shaped into the form of a Buddha. But it's also the awakened nature and some guy who may or may not have lived 2,600 years ago and the ideal of devoting your life to the great. It's all those things. Or it's maybe just a little dude with a smile. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. And when you put your hands in gassho, palm to palm, bringing yourself into a kind of oneness in the body, and then you incline your body, whether in your mind, if you're not able to actually bow, or you go all the way to the floor, your knees and your head touching, and then you lift up your arms if you're on the floor, you know, which to me has always been the gesture, all right, you take it. I can't do it. It's so much, even bowing has so much richness in it because it's going to be approached from all these different angles, the Buddha statues, everything. Everything is it. So we find our way and we get nudged and directed a little bit by the teachers.
And I see the dude with the smile appearing on my screen right now.
There he is.
So if you're looking for him,
look in the mirror.
And I'm thinking also of what Michael said about trust that came back to me as you were speaking. Yes. Yeah.
What, that was such a beautiful thing to say, Michael. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Zeph?
Hi, I have a smorgasbord, like always. I think I was really, the word that jumped out to me is when the student asks, what kind of tomb do you need or something? He uses the word need. He doesn't say, what kind of tomb do you want? He says, what kind of tomb do you need? And I'm taking the answer as a straightforward, I need a seamless tomb. If you don't build me a seamless tomb, I can't die. Not gonna happen, so get on it. And he gets on it, of course. And the other thing I thought about was, I think this national teacher guy must be a little bit of a jokester. when the emperor is coming and saying, okay, what kind of tomb do you want? How many layers? What color? And then he's like, oh, my student really familiar with it. That's kind of a funny answer. Like if Melissa died and one of us like had taken careful notes on all the things she wanted on her tomb, that would be so silly. So it's kind of a silly answer. And then the last thing is that teacher student, the one who's getting this emperor messenger, I'm kind of thinking when he hears from the emperor, he must have smiled because he doesn't know this whole background story. He's just hearing from the emperor, I'm trying to build this tomb and your teacher told me, you know, all the details, please tell me how to do it. It's kind of really sweet from the teacher to the student, this little note after death.
There is a lot of humor in this, and I think that this sort of one of the things that's humorous is what is unexpected, right? And so part of this is opening up, you know, the great does a dog have Buddha nature? Well, no. You know, all of these teachings, the point of the teachings is to disturb us out of our complacency, right? And to suggest something much more interesting and alive and expansive. So yes, and this passing the joke, we are inheritors of Bodhidharma's great joke, right? So yeah,
that's what Melissa handed off when she said, "I'll hand it off to you now."
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you deliver the punchline.
Right. Yep. Right.
Great.
And Jeff and Meg, yeah, consider also that saying nothing. We often think that saying nothing is a vacuum, but maybe he's leaving space for everything, mm-hmm, by saying nothing.
Right. Yep. Right. Exactly. Not limiting it in one way or the other, but a full presentation. Mm. Yeah.
I love that.
Thanks, Seth.
Thank you. Thanks, Seth. Thanks, Michael. Barry.
I'm grateful that Lisa Simpson has finally entered my Buddhist thinking. But seriously, thank you for the teaching. Thank you for all the teachings. Where I went with this is it's hard to sit with death and with dying people, and that monuments don't matter, similar to what Will said. And to me, what was missing in the koan was saying thank you to the national teacher and bidding him farewell. And to me, that's what was missing. And that's also common in people avoiding encounters with death.
Mm-hmm. Not an unwillingness to say goodbye and thank
you. Well, it's painful. They can't face it. It's like, oh, you might die in 100 years. Not you're dying now.
And that's a way to investigate what was going on for the emperor, right? What was
right.
His teacher was dying and he's saying, so, you know, what do you want me to do when you're dead? Let's get this together. I'm the emperor. I'll build something for you, a stupa, you know, let's, right? Yeah, so that's a definite entry point into understanding what was going on for him. And so, you know, I also appreciate him after the teacher dies and he goes and he keeps pursuing the matter. That's also interesting. We don't know enough. This, you know, he probably existed. There are records of those emperors having existed. And we don't know what was going on for him, but he was a sincere student of Zen and Chan. So it'd be interesting to find out what happened. Yeah. But you know what? What you say, Barry, also makes me remember my first teacher who's now dead. And one of the things that he used to say a lot when people would be very anxious about things that are happening right now, he would say, imagine it's 100 years from now. What about then? And I didn't realize, and maybe he didn't realize, that that was a quote from this koan and a way to talk about death, that there is, in the moment, pain and suffering around the loss of a beloved. And also there's this bigger view, a seamless, we might say, view. What's going to happen in 100 years? Probably, unless longevity studies really explode in science, none of us will be here. What then? What then? I think that's a very important question, to not get too narrow in our anxiety, but to open. Yeah, thank you. Rich?
Well, the con didn't really dazzle me in any way too much, but when David talked about gratitude to your teachers, it just really just stopped me in my tracks. You know, I almost couldn't breathe. And I've probably mentioned this before, but when I first, my root teacher, Sung San, when I had my first interview with him, and of course I had no idea what I was saying or doing, I said something and he took his Zen stick and it was broken English, tapped me on the head and he said, "You're Jewish, too much thinking." And so then I was just, I'm still struggling with it.
Yeah, these teachings, we have all received as many teachings as we will ever need. Now the matter is to decipher. Right. What in the world was tapping me on the head?
And, oh, I got it right away. It's not so easy to let go of.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Rich. Maybe just a couple more here.
Susan.
So I'm sitting here and I feel a bit, not overwhelmed, but very, very grateful for all the moments when people said different things which are touching me really deeply. So whether it was during the talk, when there was the description that the national teacher kept silent, or when the emperor said, "I don't understand." And as well, Mala, so what you brought in, what you were phrasing as an additional koan. So the other week, I came across a text from Suzushi Roshi, and there was just one line. So when I read it for the first time, it was like, wow, what is this? And he said, "Buddha's enlightenment was just to be himself." and just right now saying this again, it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So, and it's just lovely to be touched so often by just sitting here and receiving and noticing what is arising for me.
Michael, do you want to say a few words in response to that?
I love that, Susan. To just be yourself. I've heard it said that, you know, enlightenment is being more you than you could ever be. you know, it seems unbelievable to say that just being yourself, who you are, true, is it. And quite frankly, it is unbelievable. It's not something we ever want you to believe.
Yeah,
exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Let's see, Priska?
The theme about death is my it's quite vivid for me right now because my grandfather died last week. And I had the gift to be there when he died and he took his last breath, and so the words to be just myself and to trust is something that really, because the mind can go so easily with like, okay, like it, like I start to spin like around, like what should we do, like when somebody's dying, and being there and so my practice really helped me to trust and be there and not to go too far with the way, like trying to do something right or like just be there. And then the breath just stopped and it was like, it felt really natural. Mm-hmm. In some way, it wasn't. I mean, I've never experienced something like that before, and I didn't have anxiety or fear. It was just like it stopped, and it was. Yeah. And I still like it. I mean, it happened last week, and it's not like all the time on my mind. But when I start to think about, or when I remember it, and then when I sit, and when we gave the married thing we did. With the chanting, and so I remembered him, and then of course, I mean the tears come up and stuff like that. But it's like the word trust and being myself is something that helps me to kind of face the fact that he died. No. So
well, and I think death has a very bad reputation. Right, we have so many ideas and so many things, and this possibility that it is not what we think it is, and that there is not some special trick to meet it and outsmart it and find the exact. There is this a naturalness that is possible in the great mystery of coming and going, and then it's all a blessing. First breath, last breath, this breath. This is the seamless monument already constructed.
And it makes me think back to this Lotus Sutra chapter that we recited, you know, that Will was referring to. Leonard Cohen has a wonderful song called Who by Fire. And it's all the different ways that people die. And it's similar in that, you know, that we just can't know what's going on, and everything is so unique. Although it's true that every one of us will die, how we meet it, what happens, you know, it's just, it's a kind of, it's yet one more mysterious entry point on the path. How is it now? How is it now? And when we're mourning someone, to allude back to what Barry was saying, how we mourn and grieve is also, even though, you know, there's some kind of, you know, the seven steps and the five steps, depending on where you're trained, it's actually, that's also quite unique. And so to really meet moment by moment, how is it now? How is it now? How is it now? That's what you're practicing. That's what the practice is.
Yeah.
So we're going to end our Dharma dialogue there. And those of you who raised your hands and didn't get called on, please contribute to a later conversation. And we will go back.
Take a few breaths.
To sitting just for a few moments. Mm-hmm.